Discussion will be in Italian.
Italienisch, Englisch und Deutsch werden wir jetzt reden in der.
Richard Sennett für diesen im besten Sinne komplexen Vortrag.
Well, thank you very much for this complex presentation, Richard, with all these urban planning tips. So you provided us with lots of food for thought for a discussion. So you're in favor of an open city, a city which favors a democratic coexistence, promotes the latter. Many of our major conurbations, what we especially know in Berlin, are like a fighting zone. Like residential area has become rife to speculation. Then we've got gentrification, questionable housing policy. As a result of that, rents tend to go up. And here we have scarce housing available in popular districts. And we have the displacement taking place, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sure you in the audience have experienced the Berlin tough housing market firsthand. Now, I would like to take a look at this competition for housing, and apart from Richard, I would like to welcome two guests in order to join me in this debate. They are, you know, battle-proven. Francesca Bria, we need to clarify whether you're from Rome. Are you from Rome?
I live and work in Catalonia, Barcelona. Genau. Only foreigner in the Catalan government, so...
Wunderbar. Yes. Zu uns gekommen aus Barcelona. Sie ist Sozialwissenschaftlerin.
Yes, she joined us from Barcelona. She's a social scientist and she's been working in the city government of Barcelona for 2 years as a commissioner for technology and digital innovation. And she also liaises or consults the EU Commission concerning smart cities. Very welcome, Francesca. And very welcome also to André Holm. He's rather famous in Berlin. He's also a social scientist, sociologist, and he worked on gentrification, housing policy, seminar publications 2016. In 2016, he had a brief stint as the state secretary for housing, and now he is a representative of the left-wing faction of parliament. André Holm, my first question goes to you. I don't know whether you share my impression. When I listened to Richard's presentation, I thought one thing was lacking, i.e. the strong political dimension, which is usually inherent in housing nowadays. So to begin with, he said something about it very briefly, but for diplomatic reasons, he kept his political opinion under a bushel or low profile. But for many people, it's not just about housing or how they want to live, but whether they can afford any kind of... André Holm, what's your take on Richard's presentation? Is there anything yet that you missed? I learned an awful lot. I mean, I would like to thank you for that. Heartfelt gratitude. I also read the book. Now, maybe I need to start from a different angle, go off on a brief tangent. Well, I mean, let me just beat the drum for the book, because it's a very optimistic book, because despite the fact that it's got lots of contradictions and the conflicts which it describes in the city, it gives you the idea that in theory it would be so easy to have a nicer life in city, to create a better life in city. Partly it's to do with structures, with architecture, different mediation processes in order to reconcile different interests. And if you want to see that city in theory could work differently, then you have to read Richard's book. But something that's somehow a subtext, which is not spelled out, is why these wonderful ideas, which have been around probably ever since the pizza smell was in the air at the INT, whether this is not actually implemented in reality. And I mean, that brings us to the tough reality. Reality bites. We are faced with the realities that stock-listed housing companies don't have an interest in an open city. We have letterbox companies based in Luxembourg who turn a blind eye on the way in which differences in cities are reconciled. And unfortunately, we are learning the hard way. The traditional urban planning is indeed not open to an open system, but it's rather more a top-down doctrine. Well, I've been active in Berlin for quite some time. I also experienced glimpses of an open city in brief snapshots. The best times for open cities were always the absence of utilization interests and if there was a lack of planning by the state, by the government. So if both were absent, an absence of capital and the government created a window of opportunity for shaping an open city. And the question is, can we re-establish this situation, this scenario at a political level? Can we orchestrate this political? Francesca, you say yourselves, or recently in an interview you repeated, you said that you do a revolution in town hall in Barcelona. So I think it's like in the media lab, which Richard told us about. I don't know whether there's the smoke of pizza in the air. And ever since the citizen platform has taken over the government business, quite a lot of things have changed in Barcelona. So what's your take on the open city, the way Richard presented it?
Thank you. Well, first of all, thanks, Richard. It's been very inspiring because I think I do see a lot of politics, actually, in what Richard is talking about. And maybe because being Italian, I feel very comfortable with this idea of open disorder, unfinished, self-organized chaos. I mean, maybe I feel at home, you know, a bit. I'm from Rome, but also I go often to Naples. So you were showing picture about the global south, but actually this feels very much like the south of Europe and where I come from. And I also feel very comfortable with this idea that you need to repoliticize the question of the built-in environment. So to me, but also I think the Barcelona moment, what is happening in Barcelona, we interpret the open city very much as a democratic revolution, let's say. And I think, obviously, what that means is that first of all, thanks for the positive approach, because obviously he started by saying we are in a difficult moment where nation states are withdrawing from the big problems that humanities have. And we see more and more rising populism and nationalism, which is right-wing nationalism. So somehow I see in your context some kind of hope that cities can stand against, I mean, can be a counterpower to the rising international of fascism and can say, actually, we are here to take back power from below. And I think this is very much maybe awful, but a possibility to actually show that it is possible somehow to take back the city for the people. And this is, of course, extremely difficult in a political sense, because I think when you're talking about porosity and borders, I have to say I agree with Andres that, first of all, how can you make government more porous? How can you make government more, how can you get government devolving power to people and to the citizens? And how can you, of course, face the big economic and political interest that stand against this project? So I think, in a sense, for us, for instance, in Barcelona, co-producing the city with the citizens, it really means a democratic revolution. I mean, it means participatory democracy. So it doesn't mean that actually you have government planning top down and you have government experts or even urbanists that have this dream of the perfect city and the clean city and the rational city. I mean, this is actually my world. I've been called by Ada Colau to come to Barcelona to find an alternative to the smart city. I think we're going to talk about that. But I think, I mean, everything you have said, it is actually what is happening all around the world with the smart city project, which is rationalizing and creating the digital equivalent of the gated community. So just to maybe conclude this first part, I think that the Open City should be a political project, should be about taking back the city for the people and align, I mean, repoliticizing technology, the built environment, and what we need to do in cities, which for us is affordable housing, energy transition, create more public space, and then also taking back democratic control over resources, over public assets, and over the financial means that make possible this democratic control.
Bleiben wir mal für einen Moment bei einer Bestandsaufnahme.
Okay, let's take stock of this combat around cities. So, Richard, where do you see the biggest dangers for the city, as open city at the moment?
Well, what I would say about this too is I agree with both of you. I don't see, these are proposals about what we might do if we had the power to do something. I'm very struck by your example of this non-building. That is actually most informal spaces are something that are not just neutral. They've been made by someone or by some kind of usage. And one of the defects of a lot of planning, particularly if I may say German planning, is its hatred, its fear among German professional planners of things they haven't made themselves. And you need the power or the opportunity to do that kind of informal planning, but it's my point to you would be is a physical environment is being shaped for us, for the kinds of work we're doing. People need, for instance, you don't create a clean water system without some kind of technical expertise. Just can't happen. And I think in the kinds of work we do, and I think by analogy, the same thing, just as you said, the idea should be a different kind of planning, which is working with people to open things up, to suggest possibilities if they haven't thought of it, whatever. In the book, I try to look at this, there's a chapter on co-production, which is the kind of planning I do with communities. But I think we're on the same page with one caveat, okay? Which is that I think that the notion of resisting, the idea of resistance is not sufficient for politics. I don't believe that. I think that there has to be an element, just as in the Media Lab, of what's impossible, you know, what might be. That has to be an element of politics. You can't deny imagination to the work of politics. And we need more of it, you know. Resistance alone is not a way of imagining a different kind of future.
Widerstand ist aber das, was den Kampf um die Städte sehr stark prägt im Moment. Es gibt viele Kiez.
So resistance actually strongly marks the fight around the city. There's many neighborhood initiatives which try to fight certain investments, certain buildings are not erected, for instance, Google Campus, etc. But how can you take an intelligent step beyond this? If you say resistance alone is not good enough, I mean, co-production, what could it look like?
Ich bin ganz froh, dass wir jetzt doch einen Streit.
I am delighted that we agreed to disagree at least in one point, because we tried long and hard to find any areas where we disagree. And I think in terms of resistance,
dass diese Widerständigkeit.
Yeah, so this resistance it just tends to have this conservative, preservative, stagnation character at the essence. All the social tenants, all these initiatives, which a neighborhood in the Keats, which organize themselves or orchestrate their activities around the activities of the Google campus, which is supposed to receive a completely character now. So if you take a closer look at these initiatives, then you say, okay, these are resistance initiatives. They are against investments. They're against change. But if you take a closer look, who is moving where and how there, then I think it's actually an element of the open city, which Richard described and which he spoke about today. I mean, it brings to together people from lots of different neighborhoods, classes and positions, which just happen to be neighbors in the same area, and they jointly organize themselves. And actually, this is open city at its best, where people, which brings together people from different cultural and religious backgrounds, thousands of different walks of life, and they find a joint expression and point of departure. And I think here the sociality, which is supposed to be engendered by an open city, is expressed very strongly in these resistance fights or movements. And the drama about it, however, is that actually it was necessary for this strife, that you need to organize yourselves as a city in order to make sure that the grocery stores stays in, or the vegetable store stays in the street. I mean, this is bizarre what we are experiencing right now. Francesca, question to you. In Barcelona, maybe you're more advanced, because the host of initiatives propelled you to the political arena and you bring alternative ideas of urban planning to Barcelona. What were the actions that you took? Analog measures, Richard would probably like these analog measures or binary measures, analog measures, but also digital strategies. So what are the digital strategies for urban planning in Barcelona?
Well, first of all, I think Richard said something like, you can't build a political party around the idea of a flexible housing or open housing. That's maybe true, but you can actually build a very powerful movement around the idea of affordable housing and the right to housing in a city. And so this is how Ada Colau became the mayor of Barcelona. So she was a campaigner for the right to housing. So she was fighting against eviction of people that were expelled from their homes due to the financial crisis and austerity. And then because of a popular movement, and so because of a lot of years of people actually in a very open cities way, as Andre is talking about, occupying squares, debating about the economy, debating about financial alternatives to austerity and cuts to the public sector, and kind of planning the future, that movement then became a movement in the institution, if you want, or became a citizen platform that was what it in power to change the institutions from the citizens. So actually, I think that we cannot do anything of the kind of radical agenda that we are bringing forward in Barcelona if it wasn't for social movement and struggles in the streets and in society that make possible even to bring forward some of those issues. So the question of, I'll get to the digital, but I think that for us, the technology policy and the digital is so connected to the kind of model that we want for the city. So we don't start from the technology at all, so we don't even start from our enemies, like we don't even start from Facebook or Google or the big platform that are the predatory digital platforms, but we start from the kind of Barcelona that we want to build, which is, you know, more affordable housing for people, which is about how do we create more public space. We have a participatory planning process, it's called Superblocks. Actually, this is built in Barcelona from the heritage of Cerdà, which was a planner that built a city of grid that now allow the city administration to create districts that are free from cars, in order to have more green space and improve air quality and fight climate change, and also control gentrification, because we are very concerned that when you create more green space, even if you do it with the residents, then it may increase the house prices and real estate speculation. And this is like a big project that really has been so conflictual. I mean, we had a lot of conflict, so I want to bring the question of conflict in. You cannot build an open city, which is a democratic city, without conflict. I mean, you're going to have so much interest. Some of the interests, of course, are about, you know, the degree of financialization that we have, the fact that we inherited 30 years of neoliberal policies, of this kind of growth and debt fuel consumption, and we are there to try to take back, yes, the city for inhabiting a different model. So the question of housing, for instance, I mean, Barcelona, with the limited power that cities have, and I want to stress this because in the neoliberal fantasy, cities are gonna solve everything, right? Cities is the new political actor that are gonna make possible, I don't know, like a new age of capitalism. But actually cities, even when they're rebelling to the situation, they have limited power. And this limited power, for instance, in housing is very clear. Like Ada Colau, we are fining banks that leave empty apartments. We take back the empty apartments for social housing so that we can increase the social housing park, which is something I'm sure you're looking at also in Berlin. We've been fighting the kind of Airbnb and Uber type of business model, which is actually making a lot of externalities in the city, increase of rent price by 30% for people that want to live in the city center. Uber has taken all the transportation market, creating a very big problem for public transportation system. So I think this is, for us, a resistance that's very important in order to build an alternative. So getting to the digital alternative for us, I mean, we politicize the question of ownership of data. At the very core, we want to give back a sovereignty of data and control of data to people and not to the big corporations that are using technology and data to make profit. And we want to look at how does it look when the immense wealth and immense wealth which is produced by data can be given back to the cities and to the citizens in order to create public value and not just private profit for a few. And then we are articulating a series of alternatives that goes around, you know, a cooperative service provision and more, you know, democratic models also of managing problems like tourisms and that kind of things.
Richard Sennett, wie gefällt Ihnen, was Sie hören über
Barcelona? Okay, Richard, what do you think about Barcelona? What you heard about Barcelona? Na?
I mean, I don't. Obviously, it isn't. It isn't either. It's not either or, the physical or the social. That would be silly. I'll tell you one problem that's been on my mind in doing public space projects, which may resonate with you or not. A public space should be a place where strangers can meet. And that has a real generational character to it in many emerging cities, which is that villagers who come in to a city, they clump together for mutual support, help, and so on. Their children want to be released from that kind of community. They want another, a life which is more in the city itself. And we've been trying to think about how we can think about public space as a space which is a kind of release from community, in which you're with people who are different from you. How you can use, you know, this phrase, Stadtluft macht frei in German. Meant release, I don't know how my accent you forget, you know, meant release from kind of traditional bonds. And every city has that problem, particularly among very poor people, that this is a kind of generational tension. One of the reasons I'm so interested in porous public spaces is that there are spaces in which people can be with others for a while, but they're not spaces in which people live, in which they dwell in the sense of sleep. And I'm, this comes back to the issue of informal public spaces, that a lot of our thinking should be about temporary use of places, and that, you know, kids can get away from their culture for a while in a city. And that's a whole different regime about how we think about what cities are doing. I mean, my notion about this is, as I say, my notion about this is not the open city as a kind of weapon, but as a set of propositions about where you might arrive, where you might go. And it has powers built into it, you know, but it's not a weapon against the master class in the sense of providing, as you say, I mean, you know, organizing always has that capacity. But for people who don't organize, you know, who aren't politically motivated, they have a right to the city as well. And often those are they're very minor. You know, they're experiential, everyday experiences of being an urbanite rather than being excluded. So that's the kind of thing that has been on my mind. This all sounds wonderful, and it all should happen. But then for me, the question is, well, then how will you live? You know, if you got more control over your life, how would you live? And what I don't think we should think is that you should live as it was before, you know? And that you want to make places which reflect what it's like today. And this is, to me, the positive aspect of smart cities, that they give people a kind of entry into they could give people an entry into the city, as well as in places like Curitiba, in Brazil, where which is a smart city about doing collective budgeting, which give people a sense of having a project in common. So I don't think there's a conflict between us, but I think it's a kind of, I don't know, maybe it's something happened to me when I got old. I got more I got more interested in how to live rather than the difficulties of what stands in the way of living. I don't know, maybe that's the degradation of old age. I don't know, maybe something like that.
Ja, ich möchte nochmal auf ein Problem, einen Konflikt zu sprechen kommen, denn objektiv betrachtet stehen ja nicht nur Barcelona und Berlin, sondern...
Okay, so we're not just talking about Barcelona and Berlin when we're talking about major challenges. Cities are under a huge amount of pressure. In 2050, two-thirds of people will be living in cities, politicians...
Die deutsche Bundesregierung...
Well, the German government said... that up until 3 years, they want to have 1.5 billion new homes erected, and part of them should be social housing. And here, it's going to be a tightrope act, i.e. urban planning on a large scale, on a larger scale, and how you can resolve the issue of urban planning on a larger scale so that even the smaller people can still survive, smaller minds can still survive. So maybe also, André, you can also comment on that. The question of new building, what would you build, is a question that's always, it's a perennial question or high on the agenda of government politics in recent years. And the question, what would you build, tends to suggest answers which cannot be delivered. So promises of new housing in cities. And, you know, the only thing is we need new construction and everything will be hunky-dory. I mean, rents will go down more people will have space and will have a better quality of life in cities. But that's wrong. in the structures in which we live, maybe that's the case. Maybe the housing market will relax if there's bigger supply. But the housing market won't relax in those price ranges where you have the biggest biggest scarcity. So new buildings in Berlin won't be $15, but won't be $16 or $15. So they will be relaxed in the higher price brackets and not in the brackets for socially vulnerable people. And so, I mean, it's like an add-on. I mean, we're talking about housing and the settlements that are being built and are supposed to reflect the diversity of cities and so on. But in my view, it's a fallacy. You know, it's about open city. Open city means open to everyone. And, you know, a new housing that is currently being planned is absolutely not open. It's reserved to a few elite people. And, you know, it's not affordable housing. And we're saying, okay, we will have a housing program and where 25% social housing, and now social housing is supposed to be recategorized at $15 per square meter, like for 3 square foot. And in terms of people living on the dole, they would never be able to afford this. And I would really welcome it that if sooner or later we could talk about how this beautiful new city, new open city, is supposed to be built. But right now, I think it's a political and economic fight for making sure that the city is being built for the right people, for the right destinies. And that is not the case right now.
Francesca Bria.
Francesca, how do you build a city for the right people? Because we could also go and say certain groups will be left out. We talked about the digital platform. I mean, isn't this only catering for the needs of a small elite? What about exclusion in your vision of the open city?
Let me say, I mean, the question of housing and affordable housing and for whom you're building is really critical. But also, the city is about infrastructure, is about social infrastructure, is about basic services like water, like energy, like transport, which is basically our welfare system. And I think, you know, what actually is happening in Barcelona, which I think is very interesting, is a wave of, let's say, remunicipalization of those basic services, in particular to decide what kind of model you want. So for instance, we have created an energy company, which is called Barcelona Energia, which has to favor the energy transition and create more renewable energy. And this renewable energy is gonna make public buildings self-sufficient, but also go to people that have been, basically their lights has been cut off by big energy giants because we have a problem of energy poverty. So people cannot pay their bills at the end of the month. And so now the municipal company, which is not just run by the government, because we are opening a participatory democracy for the governance of this company, so it will include citizens themselves, unions, cooperatives, in the production of energy, but also in the management of this company. And I think this is about also getting people, I mean, not only to share, you know, the assets and the wealth and the resources of the city, which are shared. There should be more of a common good than privatized assets, but also to determine the kind of governance. I know that this cannot happen for everything, but I have to say we have a pretty radical approach to participatory democracy at the moment. I mean, imagine that, crazy as it sounds, we have opened up completely the creation of the city government agenda to people. So yes, what it used to be very bureaucratic and only for bureaucrats, allocate budget, public money to projects and resources and decide what to do. In the case of Barcelona, this has been done through months of participatory process. That didn't happen only online. So we do have a digital democracy tools, which actually is free software. We don't use Microsoft. The city of Barcelona has invested 80% of its IT budget into free software, open standards, and interoperability, also because we want these immaterial resources to be in the public domain. I mean, to be digital commons, to belong to the citizens of Barcelona, not just to the companies. But then we also go to the streets with assemblies and participation and you know, very contested form of deciding what is good to do in the city. And there is where you see the exclusion, where you see difference in classic, ethnical background. You also see question of gender. So actually this is the reason why Barcelona is a feminist city, first of all, because you see a lot of exclusion from women, even in taking part in decision making. And that's, I think, the big challenge of, okay, you decide, even in the moment where you take political decisions, there it's where I think it doesn't work anymore, the top-down, you know, not only planning approach, but also the top-down decision-making approach. That's where you really have to change the way that you are building the city together with the citizens and also take the difficulties of that, which is a lot of contestation, and sometimes you succeed and you have a very strong social impact, and sometimes, you know, you fail and you learn from those failures. I think that in that sense, maybe that's what I like also, this experimentation of the city model. You can make experiments, also you can fail, and that's where you can leave it open to a process. You don't need to, no, finalize everything. Mm-hmm.
Good.
Ja, auch große Konzerne machen natürlich mit der Stadt Experimente, wenn man zum Beispiel.
Big corporations also carry out experiments. Google builds the smart city sidewalk in Toronto, and this is also taking care of the needs of the city, energy supply, water, and so on. There are similarities to Barcelona. This is about implementing ideas, affordable housing, quality of living, diversity of the population. All this is to be enhanced. The city is a city with automatic cars, and you have robots who take care of your waste, and everything is controlled by big data. Is that our future?
Right, so I think the model of Google building the smart city in Toronto, actually they don't call it smart city, they're smart enough not to go into the rhetoric of smart city.
Sidewalks.
Because, yeah, so it's Sidewalk Labs, which is a spin-off of Google, Alphabet, actually. And they're just taking over a district in Toronto and built a privatized city where the critical asset will be managed by Google. And of course, through a model of it, like, you know, we're gonna own the infrastructure, we're gonna own the data center, we're gonna own the software and the hardware. And then when the city officials ask to Google, but what is the business model of this? Who is gonna pay for what? Actually, the city officials told me that Google replied, well, let's see. You know, first you give us your data, and then we will see how we monetize the city. So, you know, for me, when I got to Barcelona, actually, Ada Colau was very clear with me. She called me in to say, I want to see technology and data to be at the service of people, not of, like, the interests of private few. And so, basically, we had to revise the entire strategy of the smart city, and the first question was about who is owning what. So we realized, you know, that in the kind of smart city project, data and information is like a meta utility. It's like water, it's like the air we breathe, it's like gas and energy, it's like transport. And basically, who is gonna control the data, and in particular, the artificial intelligence that's gonna be built on that data, will also determine what kind of political and social model will be built. And this is very clear with companies like Airbnb and Uber. I mean, because they can control, they can control the rating of the passenger, they can control the data, their data platforms, they can also establish what kind of business model. I mean, of course, it's rent extracting, and so it's hyper-financialization. And then also we have questions about labor standards and, you know, citizen rights, privacy, data protection, data sovereignty, information self-determination. So our idea is not to reject the smart city, but to say we build a digital city around data sovereignty and power to the people. And this means that, I mean, not only that is free software and open standards and privacy and security by design, that we provide encryption tools for people so that they can govern their data, but also that we're gonna determine the business and, I mean, the economic and social model. For instance, you know, energy suppliers, who is controlling energy, the question of affordable housing, do you, are you gonna go, move to the kind of Airbnb model or you try to regulate those companies? So it has a very concrete impact on people's private life. That's why I really passionate about the fact, let's not make the smart city a technocratic project, a technocratic agenda. No, it is about the life of people, and people need to understand that this has a very practical impact on the price of the rent, on the water management, access to water as a public good, on energy sovereignty, and the kind of transition towards the model that they want to live in.
André Holm. Möchte sie direkt dazu was sagen?
Ich will gerne was dazu sagen. Also weil
I would like to comment, because Berlin, Barcelona, Toronto is an invitation to compare. And Francesco was quite clear here. New technologies are tools in order to find solutions. They are not the solutions as such, which is what people begin to realize also in the smart city debate here. Technologies, smart technologies are a tool, and the whole city needs to talk about it. It cannot be just a group of gifted programmers, software developers, or others who decide. And from all I know, this is what Barcelona tries to do. And I would like to give another example, because we could talk about Berlin as well. Actually, the cities want the same. If you read the coalition agreement in Berlin, and there it says housing should be for all, the city should be more social, there should be participation. It sounds like what Barcelona does, but in practice, there are differences, and these are decisive. A, we haven't managed so far to establish a political body in Berlin. In spite of the red-green government, we have not reached a point at which the government says, we will take the city back from the corporations, from the entrepreneurs. And except of the city councillor in Berlin-Kreuzberg, none really tries to do something about it. And then if I go and compare the cities, how do we design policy? In many cities, it was as it is in Berlin, housing policy and urban policy was determined by those who were in charge of the misery and the suffering, i.e. the building industry or huge investors, and those who are financially interested in being furthermore part of the game. They are the ones who decide what you see on the political agenda. They determine the political agenda. Now, Berlin tried to change it. They said, we will have groups of experts. And in addition to the experts, we have collectives and syndicates and initiatives of people who protect the nature, which is a huge step forward, because the people who just want to make money by building in the city are not alone anymore. We are there too. Now, Barcelona, I talked to the commissioner for housing, and he said he needed 2 years until he could present the housing plan. And I mean, of course, you can go and say it's a long time, 2 years, that's a long time in order to make a plan. But he said this couldn't be done quicker because we organized 59 big citizens' assemblies, not meetings of experts, but in the neighborhoods with people who live on the spot, with all people who are involved. And these 59 meetings were not participation meetings like you have them in Berlin, i.e. a professional team collects opinions and remarks and promises to have them be part of the results later. But they really worked hard, and before each meeting, they incorporated the result of the previous meeting into the housing plan. So the new housing plan was presented to the next meeting. This is a procedure that requires a lot of effort. And if you then use several platforms, including the digital platforms, in order to collect ideas, it takes some time. It's a big thing to do. But if you claim that politics is not being made for the city and for the citizens, but with the city and with the citizens, it needs to be done. And it's not that complicated to organize a meeting and to rework plans so that people can decide. So I like the idea of having guests from Barcelona here. We should not sit in a house of world cultures, we should sit in the political bodies, actually, and talk about it. There is clearly a new political awareness we see in the cities. Will there be an interesting development in the future?
Say something at this point. That what has worried me is with this very right-wing turn that's happening in both Europe and the U.S., that they're talking about the theme this evening of democracy, that the whole democratic project will be cast into doubt. And in my generation, that was something that was contained, because there was, after the Second World War, into the financial crisis, there was the fantasy that basically to have economic growth, you had to have political openness. And that fantasy is over. And what worries me is that somehow that people will give up on democracy by equating it with populism. And my only thought about this, you know, I was thinking about, as I say, this is my last book, is there any way to change the populist sentiment, as it were, from within? To that huge question, I only think that the use of the city as a place where people are, in very non-ideological ways, are mixing with people who are different, is who are physically in the presence of the other, both in terms of ethnicity, but also in terms of class, which is a big issue for us in Britain, is a way of kind of weakening populist sentiment. So much of the populist, you know, this is something that, this was not a subject on people's minds in Europe after the Second World War. It has to be now. And the question is, how do you weaken from within the notion that the other is an enemy? And that's a question your generation has got to solve. Mine didn't solve it, because it had this fantasy that growth, economic growth, required a kind of liberal political order. We know that isn't true. But it would be terrible to give up on the democratic project, the notion that people can be together with people who are different than they are, because of that. And I guess as a final word about this, and I think this is a difference in temperament between us. To me, what democracy is about is a process. It's It's why ground up is so important to me, because it's a process that's uncertain and it's messy and, you know, it often fails. But it's something that's engaging, where people have to deal with others unlike themselves. And I'm personally very worried that we're going to give up on that process and try and find forms of democratic rule which exclude that kind of participation that changes the minds of people, as like those in the States or in Hungary, who don't want to participate in it. So that's, I agree with everything you've all three said. I guess I just have a different sense of what the problem is now, because this is an overwhelming issue in my mind. How to weaken populism? Of course, it has to be fought governmentally, but it also has to be eroded from within. And that's a whole different set of questions about political and social agency. You know?
Ich fürchte, wir sind schon fast am Ende unserer Diskussion. Wir müssen die Schlussrunde ein. Wenn die Stadtplanungspolitik in vielen...
We have almost reached the end of our debate. Now, if policy continues the way it is, we will have a dystopian situation, a fancy downtown area, nice housing for the better off, many tourists in the city, air pollution in the city. If you had to get together, the three of you, in order to build the city of the future, what would it look like, André Holm? Well, I'd love to sit with the two of you in order to talk about this question in extenso. I believe that the city of the future is a city that overcomes populism and these right-wing trends. Studies have shown in Europe and in the United States that the populist forces are strong and powerful right after a crisis or when there is imminent change. Racism, which is very powerful in our society, is often also about uncertainty. But this is, first of all, a fear from difference and from a different future more than fearing others. And then, of course, we have to look at the people in the streets, and you have looked at Pegida and Dresden. And here we see people who speak up, who have actually abandoned the political sphere and what we deem the political sphere. They think what we deem politics is hostile to them, and that's a trend we find in many other groups which are not racist at all, because they say politics today work as they worked last century. So it's not only about finding a strategy against the right wing. We need a strategy for a different policy and for a different city, a city in which you can participate. I think this will help us reduce the fear. And there is a global network of the fearless cities, municipalist movements from all over the world are united here. And it's 280 or 340 cities that get together from time to time, and they are the ruling party in Barcelona already. And they all say there was a certain mood before they launched their system, their idea, their project. But open cities are probably the best answer to these trends of radicalization. I'm not sure whether you are satisfied with these ideas. Maybe you have different ideas, but it's not about making you happy. It's about changing the world. Francesca, would you also help build the city of the future with the two gentlemen next to you?
Well, André has made such a good pitch for the Fearless City movement that actually we're building from Barcelona, but also with over 200 other cities. And I think fearless is this word that actually answers to a lot of the questions about right-wing populism, because I think I actually think that the only alternative that we see against right-wing populism and the rise of it all over the world, it is exactly taking back popular sovereignty. And I have to say, like in Catalonia or in Barcelona, people are not afraid of speaking about popular sovereignty, because this is not national sovereignty, this is not nationalism. This is really the power of the people to set the direction and to decide what kind of city and what kind of socioeconomic model they want for the future. And I think that we shouldn't be afraid of putting that forward as a model, popular sovereignty, but also radical participatory democracy as the only antidote to right-wing populism. I think this is a project that would allow us to do something like, you know, creating in Barcelona, we have an entire department that is for the refugee and the migrants. Like, we have a department which says welcome to refugee and migrants. We have a department that works on feminizing politics and, you know, gender equality across all the political spectrum and all the decisions that we take. I also think that there are fundamental questions about, you know, what kind of welfare state we want. So do you want your healthcare to be run by Google? Do you want your transportation to be run by Uber? Do you want this kind of super big tech monopolies to replace the predominance of finance and give us surveillance capitalism? Or you want a society where you can socialize data to build public value? Do you see a possibility for cities to govern as a public good water or electricity? I think these are big questions that we need to answer, and I think this is, for me, the city of the future.
Richard Sennett, Sie haben das letzte Wort. Die Stadt der Zukunft.
Richard Sennett, you have the last word here. The city of the future, built with the two others.
Well, I just like, it all sounds good. But I'd come back to both of you with a question. Maybe we talk further about it. What happens if people say to you, build me a gated community? And, yeah, but you know, there has to be an answer to that. And I think that's where the problem of popular sovereignty is. I say, I would refuse, but then I'd be out of a job. Actually, I've never built the gated community, but I think there's a fundamental problem about reconciling aspects, I say this to you as a sociologist, of people's desires with the just. And this is nothing new to me. This is every, you know, from Plato on, people have recognized this. And I think there, if I may say so, I think there is a danger in thinking that the mere fact of solidarity will break down, and communal solidarity will enable democracy. In my country, in the US, the far right is very solidaristic. You know, what the visions that you have of this, I can imagine, well, I can't say Trump, but you know what I mean. That there are ways in which solidarity is not necessarily democratic. I can't answer your question, because if you really believe in an open city, there is no the open city.
Vielen Dank. Ich glaube, das war das Schlusswort. Sind wir am Ende unserer Diskussion über den.
Thank you very much. We have reached the end of our debate. Thank you very much, Francesca Bria, André Holm, and Richard said it.